High School Slumber Party is brought to you by the Cage Club Podcast Network. For all things Cage Club related, head on over to cageclub.me. That's cageclub.me.
School is out and it's Friday night. I'm all wrapped up and I feel alright.
Welcome, patrons of Mel's Drive-In, little kids out past their bedtime, out-of-towners in cowboy hats, oh, and an extra special shout-out to that blonde in the T-bird out there. This is High School Slumber Party, the podcast where me and some friends look back at our teenage years through the lens of some iconic high school-centric films. I'm Brian Rodriguez, and the slumber party's at my place this evening. But first, school is still in session, and we got some homework to chat about.
This was your assignment, and I would like to see the results.
First of all, for those of you in the United States, happy Thanksgiving. Hope yours was as festive and enjoyable as mine was. Hope you ate some good turkey and some good food and just, you know, had a blast with family and friends. And those of you not in the United States or didn't celebrate Thanksgiving, well, happy Thursday, I guess, or yesterday. You know what I mean. Speaking of Thanksgiving, did you listen to Foodie Films, my partner on P.S. I Love Hoffman, Kyle Reinfried? You know him as the Foodie Films man himself. He's been on the show a million times. His show, of course, is Foodie Films. And not only was I on last week's episode, but I was on this week's very special Thanksgiving episode as well. A Friendsgiving, a Foodie Films Friendsgiving, if you will, where Kyle and I talk about all the Thanksgiving episodes of a little TV show. I'm not sure if you heard of it. It's called Friends. Check it out. I had a blast recording it. It was awesome. And you know where you can find that show, wherever you get your podcast, including where you're listening today, whether it be Google Play, whether it be Spotify, whether it be Stitcher, whether it be Apple Podcasts, or of course, as always, on cageclub.me. That's cageclub.me. And while you're there, don't mind, you know, going onto the High School Slumber Party area of whatever podcast app you listen with. I know you know how to get there because you're here now. And why don't you hit that review button and write us a review or give us a 5-star rating. All that helps our algorithm and all that is very important homework for you guys because I love doing High School Slumber Party. In fact, it's one of the things I'm thankful for. I'm thankful for this podcast. I'm thankful for my family. I'm thankful for my friends. I'm thankful for all the guests I've had on High School Slumber Party this year and beyond, I should say. I'm thankful for all of it. And honestly, I thank you guys for giving me purpose in life. That sounds very deep, but no, it is, because like I said, I love doing this show. I love watching these teen movies. And I love hearing from you guys, the listeners, on our social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. It's just, it warms my heart so much. So thank you, thank you, thank you. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Come on, Belle. I was in the middle of thanking everyone. Ugh, that thing rings at the most inopportune times. Anyway, lost my train of thought here. I guess the best way you can help me out is by listening, of course, but also telling a friend about High School Slumber Party. You know, that's the best way. This is the giving season. We're entering the holiday season where we give gifts. I always say the greatest gift you can give anyone is the gift of High School Slumber Party. It's free. It's weekly. It's fun, I hope. So tell a friend about High School Slumber Party. Now, your homework this week, it wasn't that hard, because if you did your homework last week, you kind of had an easy week, and that's perfect for the Thanksgiving week, the short Thanksgiving week. And it was to watch American Graffiti, and of course, listen to last week's episode of American Graffiti, but you'd know that because you're here, because this was a two-parter. This is a big film, George Lucas film. You know George Lucas from Star Wars, that guy. Well, this, some people say this is his best film, not Star Wars. Maybe yes, maybe no, but it's certainly one of his greatest movies, and proof that he's actually a very, very creative and talented person. So, I hope you enjoyed American Graffiti. I know my two guests did, and they're returning from last week, of course, to wrap up our discussion today. And they're Mike Manzi from a million Cage Club podcast network shows, one of the founders, the resident historian, the substitute teacher, the teacher's aide, the teacher's assistant, the teacher when I'm not here, the cool kid in class, the man at the back of the class, so many nicknames for Mike Manzi. And of course, another returning guest, one of my favorites, Chris Podcasts. Oh, it's a great episode. I can't wait for you guys to hear it. So let me just get my nickel and pop it in the old jukebox. And don't forget, pack your favorite jammies. Tell your mother you're sleeping over Brian's, because we're about to get our party on. I'm going to enjoy this nice leftover Thanksgiving sandwich with a moist maker while I play you a song called Green Onions, How Appropriate, by Booker T and the MGs. Class dismissed. You know, because the drag race is kind of the final, or one of the final scenes, we'll save John Milner for last. Let's do Kurt Henderson. Let's do Richard Dreyfuss. So he's the character, again, who's, I think he gets a scholarship right at the beginning, and mm-hmm. at the start of it, he's the most, like, reluctant to go off to college, and he's supposed to, but he's clearly questioning it. And then, of course, you know, while they're cruising, he sees that blonde in the T-Bird, and the film kind of becomes about him trying to find this girl. He's complaining originally about the quality of women has gone down, and he can't find, like, the perfect woman, and he sees the perfect woman, and he must have her.
What did you say?
Quick, hang a right.
What? Why?
Steven, cut over to G Street. I just saw a vision. I saw a goddess. Come on, you gotta catch up to her.
Didn't see anything.
Come on, Kurt, we can't be spending half the night chasing girls down for you.
Maury.
I'm telling you, this was the most perfect, dazzling creature I've ever seen.
She's gone. Get it.
She spoke to me. She spoke to me right through the window. I think she said, I love you. That means nothing to you people? You have no romance, no soul? Someone wants me. Someone roaming the streets wants me. Will you turn the corner?
Oh, Kurt.
And he keeps getting, like, hints. Like, he describes her to people, and they, one of them says, oh, she's the trophy wife of, like, a car dealer. Another says, she's a prostitute. And he keeps just, like, not believing it. He keeps chasing a reason to stay in town. And it's my favorite arc, personally, of the movie. I feel like if there was a character I was most like, it'd probably be him. He's just, like, he's just a guy. He's very much the straight man. He's the Jerry Seinfeld of the group that's, like, holding the rest of them together. And, yeah, other than a very slapsticky diversion, like, his story is very straightforward.
Yeah, that is pretty great how she does represent, like, everything he loves about home, like, why, and a reason to stay, and, like, he's desperately searching for a reason not to go, even though, like, he's totally ready to leave and equipped to sort of thrive outside of this environment. And he's almost the only one who can't see it until the end. I mean, even the pharaohs end up seeing something in him, right? And want him to join their car club, which is my favorite kind of stuff. But I also do love how, like, the movie, or at least his part, like, she just pops up in and out, like, you know, and, like, yes, like, the whole goal is to talk to her and to meet her and everything. I love the way he just keeps getting sidetracked. Like, first he goes to the hop, and then he gets in the car with his ex-girlfriend, and then he gets up with the pharaohs, and then he goes to meet the wolf man. It's so great.
Seems like both of you guys really enjoyed what he was all about.
You know, my favorite stuff in this movie, at least this screening, is when he gets mixed up with the pharaohs. They actually end up becoming a reason to leave town. I love that. But, you know, just, I don't know, like, they're like the greaser. You know, you got John Milner, who's like the car guy, but these are what you think of with like juvenile delinquency, right? Like, this is
like actually, like the movie Grease, kind of almost.
Yeah,
no, yeah, really. Yeah, right. But for real, and they even, you know, they're very imposing, and they're, you know, very threatening, and, you know, they're very the very opposite of him. But like, he finds this side of himself, like, you know, when they go to rip off the lodge. And he uses his like quick thinking because they gave him the scholarship to be like a distraction. And then when they talking about like getting over on the cops, like he has like the courage to crawl under the car and eventually like scream at the cops to get him to chase him and stuff. So I love just over the course of this, how he sort of like digs down and like realizes like, oh my God, if I could do this, like I could leave town, like I could do whatever, you know, and then just culminating with him at the Wolfman's radio station, that seemed like almost brought a tear to my eye. Like, it's just so great the way it's all set up, and he's talking about the Wolfman, and yeah, I just love like all of this stuff.
Yeah, he's a very interesting character, because back a little, when he's in the car with his ex-girlfriend, he's talking about how he saw the most beautiful girl in the world to her, and then he ends up inviting his ex-girlfriend into the back seat. And she's just like, okay, refresh my memory. What's the big incident that stops them from like doing anything?
A guy pulls up alongside, and her friend's like, oh, I really like this guy. Can you say something for
me? Oh, that's
whatever?
Right. Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, she thinks you've got rippling biceps, and like really embarrasses her.
I loved her reaction. The driver, I forget her name, I think her name was Bobby or something.
Yeah.
And she just literally stops the car and just like, get the fuck out of my car.
And you know what? That character always has like pretty much the whole movie. He's got a real, like, he's got a smile on his face. Like, he's out of everyone, I feel like he's enjoying this night the most.
Which is odd, because it seems like he has the most like he's got to make a decision here, and everyone's asking him about it. Everyone's putting pressure on him about it. But then he just kind of like rides with the night and enjoys it. And then it ends up like influencing his decision for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I don't necessarily want this, what I'm about to say, but I could definitely see this is like, this is a guy, this guy to me feels almost in the vein of something like The Graduate or something. Like, I feel like there's movies about just his journey out there that like without all the peripheral shenanigans and cutting off to like other storylines. Like this to me feels like something you can make an entire movie about, this guy.
It's funny you say that, Mike, because I think Richard Dreyfuss was like a finalist to get Dustin Hoffman's role in The Graduate.
And he's in it at the very, very end. He's like one of the lodgers where Dustin Hoffman's staying. Yeah.
Oh no, I think you hit the nail on the head with that. What about you, Chris, with this character?
Well, he's desperate to track down this mystery blonde in any way, so he goes to the radio station and talks to the just some guy who's running it, because Wolfman, his shows are broadcast from a blimp or whatever. Like, there's a different rumor that everyone has about Wolfman Jack, which I love throughout it's a running thing throughout the movie. And he just shares a popsicle and gets some advice from the guy.
Are you the Wolfman?
No, man, I'm not the Wolfman. Wait a minute.
How you doing, Diane? All right.
That's the Wolfman.
Do you love me?
He's on tape. The man is on tape.
Say you love me.
Well, where is he now? I mean, where does he work?
Where?
The Wolfman is everywhere.
Where?
Well, I gotta give him this note. Shit.
Can I wig on you, Wolfman?
Here, let me see the note. Hell, that's just a dedication, man. What I can do is I relay it. It'll be on tomorrow or Tuesday.
No. See, this is very important. You see, I may be leaving town tomorrow, and it's very important that I... Damn it, that I reach this girl right now.
You don't know whether you're gonna leave town or not?
Well, I'm supposed to go to college back east tomorrow. I don't know if I'm gonna go. I don't know.
Wait a minute. Have a popsicle.
No.
Huh?
No, thanks.
Sit down a minute. It's early in the morning.
Damn.
I can't talk for the Wolfman, but I can tell you one thing. If the Wolfman was here, he'd say, get your ass in gear. The Wolfman comes in here occasionally, bringing tapes, you know, to check up on me and whatnot. Yeah. And the places he talks about that he's been, the things he's seen. And there's a great, big, beautiful world out there. And here I sit, sucking on popsicles.
Why don't you leave?
I'm not a young man anymore. And the Wolfman gave me my start in the business, and I like it. I tell you what, if I can possibly do it tonight, I'll try to relay this dedication in and get it on the air for you later on.
That would be terrific. Really. Thanks.
Just a minute. Hey, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks a lot.
Really.
Appreciate it.
Sticky little mothers, ain't they?
They really. Six or seven of them, right?
I know. I got a whole refrigerator full.
Thanks a lot.
See you later.
Appreciate it.
And it turns out that that actually was Wolfman, and he hears that on the radio, as does the mystery blonde, and he gets a phone call. He's just got this look on his face where he already knows the answer to this. It's like he's made peace with his decision. It's like right as the sun is coming up, and she says that you know, if you're around tonight, I'll be on my usual street, which she used the word cruising. I think at the time that probably didn't mean like Al Pacino cruising, like she wasn't confirmed a prostitute.
No, yeah.
I think that's just like,
no,
the street.
This isn't
yeah.
Pacino's
cruise. Right, yeah. Because someone said, oh, yeah, it's just prostitute. So I was like, wait, oh no, okay, like this is the 60s, words mean different things. So, and he's just like, she's like, well, will I see you around tonight? And he's just like, no, I don't think we will. And I love that. I love how just, with that one line and with his facials, he really nails that character's decision and the kind of conclusion of that plot. And I love it. And that all really goes to the writing and Richard Dreyfuss. I think he's great in this.
Yeah, no, he really is. And from like the Wolfman Jack scene. And by the way, maybe we're taking for granted, maybe some of our younger audience members out there aren't familiar. Wolfman Jack was an actual DJ.
Mm-hmm.
George Lucas, one of his dreams at USC was to make a documentary on Wolfman Jack. He wasn't able to do it for whatever reason. He wrote a kind of Wolfman Jack-like character in this film, and Francis Ford Coppola said to him, hey, why not just make it Wolfman Jack? Like, that would be a cool little cameo you can do here. And they did. And I read that Wolfman Jack actually, like, ad-libbed a couple of his lines, which is awesome, because he's not, like, I mean, he's still an entertainer, so I get it. And
yeah, he's a DJ, and at that, so like all that stuff you hear him doing, all those tapes, you know, that to me, it seems like on the fly, you know, he's screwing with his audience as he's broadcasting.
Yeah, and I think it's such a great moment when you found out it's him, and I know it's a little, like it might seem a little tropey today, but I don't know how many times mm-hmm. films were doing that at the time, like the character who's the sage person, and like, mm-hmm. wink, wink, he's actually that person. But
yeah.
I loved it. And again, how Richard Dreyfuss sees it, has that smile on his face, and it almost carries him to that telephone scene. He's so excited when she calls. And it's more about like the quest being accomplished than like, because again, like you said, he knows he's leaving already. His smile brought a smile to my face
mm-hmm.
at that ending scene.
Yeah, I like how Wolfman Jack and all of the diegetic, he's the source of the diegetic music throughout this movie, and like his voice just kind of pops up here and there on the radio, which kind of creates a through line, a link between all of the characters' different stories, even when they're not together. You're reminded, like, this is all happening at the same time. And that is kind of a thing that will be just one more piece of DNA that this movie has given to cinema. I know the Warriors kind of uses that as like a Greek chorus kind of thing to great effect. And I know that there is a high school movie where like the high school radio or whatever does that. Like my head is saying it's Usher and She's All That, but I feel like there's another one that's even more prominent. It's a thing that gets used a lot, and it's really cool to see it maybe where its origins even are.
Yeah. You know, it's just that feeling again of just like continuing this. It's like song after song after song. This isn't the first movie to just replace music with like rock music instead of like the score, but it is an early one to do that. I think Easy Rider had done it before this.
But you know what the difference here and the thing that just blows my mind every time is the music is not coming through loud and clear. It sounds like it's coming through a car, like a car stereo or through a car on the other side of the street or, you know, a window from a roof, you know, from a building somewhere. Like, I just love the way the sound, it's like, you know, it's not crystal clear. It just adds to the reality so much.
Oh, yeah, no, for sure. Like, it just feels like we're along with them. I mean, not trying to put a pun here, but like along with them for the ride, you know, for this entire film. I mean, this is a great time to just talk about this soundtrack and this just like the music overall. Like, I gotta get this on vinyl. I can't believe I don't have this on vinyl. I know that's the most hipster comment if you've ever heard, but still, I need this on vinyl. Like, I can't believe I do not have it on vinyl.
I think they actually used and recorded their own 45s that they, you know, collected growing up as kids and everything, and they just put it on a hi-fi system and put a mic up to it or somewhere like a couple feet away or whatever, and they did all kinds of crazy sound design in this movie, but yeah, it's so great.
Yeah, oh, yeah, the sound is great. What you were just saying with like how it sounds like it's coming through radios. I like the handful of times when like, I think maybe it happens the most at the drive-through where like you kind of hear it layered because it's coming from so many different cars in different directions. Mm. I thought that was really awesome. And then kind of what Mike said before, and I had the same thoughts. It's like the Tarantino like would do this with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood with like most of his movies. It just feels like this is the author's like personal playlist of that time, and it's why it works so well. There's so much authenticity to it.
Yeah, and it's funny because like it's so easy for us to make a playlist today, but obviously at the time it maybe not so easy. And just I could imagine just going to the theater, seeing this film, and just being blown away by the music. And even people being like, oh, remember that song or remember that song? Like, it must have been really cool if someone was lucky enough to see this in theaters when it came out.
Oh, my God. The boomers, like, must have shit their pants every time this came out, like, for one day. And I saw it got re-released in 72, and that makes not 72, like, the late 80s, because, like, that makes sense. Like, before, like, VHS was, like, a common thing, like, the boomers needed something to feel nostalgic for that wasn't just happy days. Like, I get why this movie was so successful and then continued to be successful like 10 years later.
And it's like a jukebox as it goes along. Yeah. It's amazing. And you know, if you think of like the music at the times that was coming out when this movie came out, like so drastically different than doo-wop and that early rock and roll stuff, you know, and getting into like psychedelic music and all kinds of things, Grateful Dead and stuff. I mean, you know, Woodstock. And I mean, you know, I don't think... I mean, there might have been, I think there was some doo-wop at Woodstock, but it's just, it's just a whole different soundscape out there on the radio. So it must have been really great to go back and be like, oh my God, I remember this song. I remember this song. I remember this song. It's not like nowadays you get shit like Suicide Squad, where it's just like, you know, every new scene they're dropping a song and they're playing like a couple bars of it. And it's just like, we get it. You're obnoxious. This soundtrack blows. But like, you know, it's the same theory. It's just put into practice perfectly here.
Yeah, again, especially, it just fits so well with the film. And like I said, it's coming out of the car stereo. That's why it feels like I said, I'll say it again, like one big party throughout this film.
The song that keeps popping into my head is the, you know, Little Darling, Bop, Bop, Shun. Like, I don't know why that keeps popping into my head, but I hear that like wah 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 wah.
Maybe this is just the podcast host to me finding a segue. But no, just the one moment I loved and the reason why I love our greaser main character is because he says the Beach Boys suck, and that is something that's a hot take I agree with.
Oh, ooh. Yes, he rock and roll's been going downhill ever since Buddy Holly died. Like, I took that to heart in high school. I was like, he's probably right, and I got way into Buddy Holly.
Ooh, certainly a hot take. All right, let's talk about him then. John Milner. Again, I love this character. He is the Fonzie. He is the bad boy, but he's still like, he's not in the Pharaohs or anything.
He's Solo. Yeah. He's Han Solo. Oh,
saw what he did there. He's still friends with this main clique of, you know, kind of, I don't want to say nerdy guys, but the two other guys, I mean, they're pretty nerdy, you know, they're not. I know he's class president, one of them, but they're all like, seem like relatively smart, you know. I'm not saying that Milner is dumb, but he certainly, you know, he's all about that bad boy greaser lifestyle. Like, if he's in the boy band, he's still in the boy band, but he's the bad boy, you know.
Do you think all greasers had the time? It was like a Jedi Master and Padawan kind of thing, because like the Fonz had geeky little Richie Cunningham. Do you think all greasers had like a little geek to protect and like carry around with them?
Oh man, I hope so. That's really cool if that's the case.
I love that about him. It like, it's what sets him apart. Like, I mean, he does have those friends, but he kind of is just, I always took him more as like a loner, because he's not in a car club like the Pharaohs. Like, he's not out there like committing crimes. Like, he's just a cruiser, like straight up. And he's a mechanic too, you know, like his stroll through the graveyard. He knows about the culture, the car culture so much. And like, that, I love that's what he represents. And I love that their clique are all sort of like this, you know, it's like they got the really cool kid, they got the really nerdy guy, and then they got like two guys who are sort of like in the middle of that, right? Like, they could go either way, sort of. Like, I feel like any minute now, one could be really cool and the other could be super nerdy, but they're right down the middle. You know, again, the movie, I feel it's like everyone would judge these kids by the way they dressed and the way they looked, and, you know, would never give them a shot. And like, parents would never, you know, talk to a guy like John Milner seriously unless they needed like their hubcaps changed or like a tire changed or something. But like, he's got a heart of gold. Like, he takes care of this kid the whole movie, you know. He's friends with straight guy, like the straight people. Like, they're not out there juvenile delinquents and stuff. Mm-hmm.
It's such a good character moment, how when he sees Toad getting beat up, like, he immediately pulls that car over and sprints into that fight, like, no hesitation whatsoever. It's just, it's a really good character moment, because you don't have, really, they don't intersect that much here and there until the very end of the movie. So I do love that one, that intersection, more than any of the others.
I agree with that. And of course, he's, well, he has a bad or good reputation, depending on, you know, how you feel about it. But he's known as the fastest drag racer in town. He's got that yellow hot rod, very beautiful looking car. And it just, for him, it's just about cruising and racing. And when he pulls up to that car with the girls, he just wants a girl to hop in with him. Someone suggests their sister, and out comes this little girl, and she just becomes his companion for the night. Originally he's trying to get rid of her, and again, I just love their dynamic. Mm-hmm. As we said, Mackenzie Phillips acts so well. And they play against each other so well. What were your favorite moments between the two of them before we get to the end?
I loved when they jump out of the car of the people who threw a water balloon at them, and they I don't know why she just has shaving cream, but they just like trash the car a little bit, but like in a playful way. And it was just a neat little character moment. I enjoyed that.
Did you read that the water balloon wasn't really supposed to hit her?
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was supposed to hit, I think, either him or, like, just blow up, not blow up, you know, like, break in the car, and it hit her right in the face, and them laughing was just, like, their natural take. And
oh, that's so good.
George Lucas kept it in, which, yeah, I think is awesome.
Yeah, good, that was such, George, a Lucas, such a natural moment there. I didn't remember thinking, like, she kind of looked like she didn't see it coming. Yeah. Side note, did you catch the license plate of his car?
Yeah, THX.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, THX 138. Love it.
Yeah, that's perfect. Mike, how about you? Any other moments with her and him that you liked?
So, like, I really like all the stuff going on in the car, but I like at the end how he gives the little memento for her to remember him by. I thought that was really sweet. Like, after all that, like, You know, like I could probably, they'll probably hang out again sometime.
Yeah, no, those elements were great because, again, he's trying to get rid of her. She kind of like, I mean, I didn't see it as creepy, but then eventually, like, he's joking around, like, coming on to her, and that's when she's like, finally gives him her address and takes her home, but she wants that piece. And she's like, oh, it's like a ring, so it kind of means we're going steady. And he's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. I don't know. They played off each other really, really well. There's also that scene where I guess it's like a rich kid, and he goes up to him, and he's talking about like getting his car fixed, and he kind of has to go into his like professional mode, like, yes, sir, I'll fix it. And it's like, by the way, this is my cousin. And she gets upset with him.
What do you say, Al?
Not much. Say, you think if I brought my Mopar by the shop on Monday, you could spot weld the bumper bracket?
Sure, anything. Just come by before noon, all right?
Sure, fine. Hey, you met Linda?
No. Hi, Linda. This is my cousin, Carol. Carol, Linda, Al.
Babysitting.
Yeah, Jesus, watch it, will you? Been hitting me all night. Kids will be kids, you know. Come on, goddammit! Why don't you grow up, for Christ's sake? We don't get along too well. You know how it is. Been like this all.
Spastic creep.
I just love, again, their play with each other and kind of like, they're both trying to be something they're a little bit not,
yeah.
And then having to just, I don't know, like show who they really are in certain moments. And it almost represents a little bit of his innocence. And once she leaves the car, it's just like, something bad's going to happen. I didn't remember, to be honest with you, if he died or not in this film. Mm-hmm. You know, spoiler alert, he doesn't. But I was afraid, like, oh my God, wait, does he die after, like, she left the car? Because I don't know. I thought it was, like, that was the last time she would ever see him or something.
Yeah, I love it because they're the only two that, for the most part, they're stuck in a car together for the entire movie. Like, not necessarily trapped or anything, but, you know, more than anyone else, we're picking up and they're in that car. And they're almost going through, like, a whole relationship together. Like, you know, at times they're, like, bickering brother and sister, but by the end, they're genuine friends, I feel. Like, they've actually forged a bond of some kind, and they'll be friends.
Yeah, it's, like, really sweet. I don't know.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we build to the drag racing scene. I mean, I'll just ask off the bat, what did you think of this scene? It's Harrison Ford is hunting, essentially, him down for this big race, because he's the best in the valley. And how'd you think this scene played out? Because I got some opinions.
I love that the cowboy hat was just because he didn't want to cut his hair. Like, it's something that works out so well. Because he is kind of like the hot shit cowboy who like strolls into town to challenge the fastest gun in the West, you know? And he's just kind of this presence looming over the whole movie throughout. But it's not like a threatening presence at all until Ron Howard's girlfriend gets in that car. And then once everything kind of starts to come together, there's a lot of tension there.
Yeah, and then even his run-in with John earlier is played more for laughs, and they do sort of like a test run from light to light. They're like, that was real Fast and the Furious, and they're throwing insults at each other, talking about how ugly their cars are and all that kind of stuff.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Hey man, I'm sorry if I scared you.
You're gonna have to do one hell of a lot more than that to scare me.
Yeah, but looking all over for you, man. Didn't nobody tell you I was looking for you?
Hey, I can't keep track of all you punks running around here backwards.
Hey, you're supposed to be the fastest thing in the valley, man, but that can't be your car. It must be your mama's car. I'm sort of embarrassed to be this close to you.
Yeah, well, I'm not surprised driving a field car.
Field car? What's field car?
Field car runs through the fields, drops cow shit all over the place to make the lettuce grow.
That's pretty good. Hey, I like the color of your car there, man. What's that supposed to be? Sort of a cross between piss yellow and puke green, ain't it?
Well, you call that a paint job, but it's pretty ugly. I bet you got to sneak up on the pumps just to get a little air in your tires.
Well, at least I don't have to pull over to the side just to let a funeral go by, man.
Oh, funny. You know what?
Your car's uglier than I am.
He can talk the talk, but at the end, you know, even John says, like, he could have had him. He's just, he was too stupid, too cocky or something, you know, and John just never, or at least in this movie, you know, we find out that, like, he just never really, you know, he's too acute, too aware, like, he knows the game too much, like, what to do, that he never loses that control, even if he was gonna lose. Like, he'd rather lose than crash, but Bob Falfa would rather crash to win.
Yeah, I totally forgot about that trash talk scene. I like how the little girl, like, tries to be a part of it, and she's like, your car is uglier than me, and stuff like that. So, I mean, the physical drag racing, though, I don't want to say I was disappointed, but I'm so used to, like, the high-level Fast and Furious drag races of of today's cinema that I was like, oh, I mean, it's cool that the car blew up, but that was it? It took, like, two seconds, but I know that's accurate.
There's two things I truly love about it. One is the build-up, for me, is, like, like you said, like, kind of the whole movie. And then once the girl gets in the car with him, you're like, all right, this is, you know, something bad's going to happen. And so the actual race, it's not so much how it, like, plays out to me. Mm-hmm. It's more like the build up in the moment. But I also feel like this is not shot cinematically intentionally. Like, this is a real, this is how it must really look, right? Like, it's quick, it's brutal, it's fast, and it's dangerous. And, you know, it's out in the middle of nowhere. And when someone rolls their car, they better get out of there fast, because back then that shit would just, you know, explode on you.
Yeah, it's not in the middle of Tokyo. We're not getting, like, interior engine CGI shots, so it's just different. But again, like you said, it's real and it's cool. Any thoughts on it?
Yeah, I feel the same way. For something that was built up so much, it is over quickly, and that's fine. My only issue here was I felt the editing in this movie was so good that the editing of the crash is actually terrible. Like, it keeps cutting between different perspectives and angles so many times. It reminded me of, like, a Jackie Chan movie where, like, they did the stunt so many times and it was so dangerous that, like, they just used different camera angles despite breaking the pace and, like, the immersion of the film. So that's the only thing that really pulled me out of it. But, I mean, it was, like, the last 5 minutes of the movie anyway, so.
Yeah, and we get that that iconic shot of Ron Howard, like, back with the girl, and it's evident that he's gonna stay. We already discussed the conversation from the blonde on the phone with Richard Dreyfuss, and then again the conversation with the geeky guy and John Milner, and just in terms of what you were saying, Mike, where he's like, he would have had me, and he genuinely seems, like, disappointed. You know, that's where does it end? In the airport, right? And it's that old film switcheroo. The guy who was everyone thought was leaving stays, and the one who everyone thought was staying leaves. But I didn't mind it. I kind of like when movies do that. What'd you think of just, like, where every character, not the little epilogue, but where every character wound up at this point at the airport?
Yeah, that was fine by me. I think it made sense for everybody. I feel like the only one who maybe didn't get a clear, like, end to their arc. Well, I guess Toad did. It just comes a little bit before all of that. And then at the drag race, John gets his, and then Dreyfuss and Cunningham here. And yeah, the switch is good. He even says the same thing that Dreyfuss says at the beginning of the movie, like, I think I'll stay and do 1 year of junior college. And I think the ending on the plane, the symbolism's maybe a little heavy-handed, just him looking out of the plane and seeing the white T-Bird driving by. But I don't know, I really liked it anyway. Again, just Dreyfuss's emotions and his face, his reactions throughout this whole movie, I was on board with him the whole time, and I was really rooting for his character, and I think that's a great send-off to the movie.
I'm surprised he wasn't nominated, honestly. He's the one I would have picked. What about you, Mike?
Yeah, I really love this. I love the idea that like, he's been up all night, and now he's going to go on that plane, and he's going to go off to school when he's, like, so energized, and everybody is. Everybody's still so up after that late night. But it's a great curtain call, you know. That's what, everybody's here together to see him off. And you know, it's kind of funny you say they pull, like, the switcheroo, but I always had this feeling watching it, even for the first time, I was like, Ron Howard's not going anywhere, and, you know, Richard Dreyfuss is definitely going to make that flight. Like, I don't know, there's just something about it. I don't feel like the movie's necessarily trying to trick anybody.
No, I don't think that.
And it's, you know, it's in the air, obviously, but I don't know. I just always had the feeling that he was going to get on that plane, so I'm always happy when he does. And maybe nowadays the most striking thing I'm realizing is like they're right there on the tarmac, and he just like walks up one of those, you know, flights of stairs onto his plane, which like only, you know, the elite 1% can do these days, I guess, or if you're, I don't know, if you own your own plane.
Yeah, which is the elite 1% pretty much. Yeah, no, I forgot what the airline was called, but it was something funny. And that was slightly distracting. You know, maybe it was a real airline at the time.
It'd be funny if it was like Sith Airlines.
Yeah.
And we all missed it.
Sebulba Air.
Sebulba Air.
That's right, guys. That wasn't a drag race. That was a pod race.
Oh, God. Do you think that he was, you know, did you see any of the pod racing in this drag race?
I'm just no, kidding. but if you go back and you do watch, if you go watch that pod race, like that is definitely like him trying to play with his, you know, Matchbox cars again and be like, all right, everything is, it's because those pods are just giant, huge engines that drag a person
oh, yeah.
in a seat, you know? So it's just, you know.
They're very hot rod-like when you
yeah,
look back
yeah, they're
it.
Space hot rods. That's exactly what I was trying to get to.
I remember being in Modesto. That was my Tatooine. You know, like that's totally like what he was fucking saying on set.
Yeah, over on pod racing on Planet Bob Alpha. Whatever.
Here's another hot take for me. I like the pod racing sequence in The Phantom Menace. It just belongs in a different movie.
Oh, no, I don't disagree with that. Like, I do actually like pod racing. Like, sometimes I think it feels like, or it's maybe today people are going to think, oh, just completely shit on all of George Lucas's work after right. this film. But no, there are cool elements. It's just funny.
Brian, you and I have discussed at barbecues before doing, like, well, I've talked about maybe doing Star Wars podcast at one point, not, but we talked about, like, you know, just doing a podcast about pod racing called The Podcast.
Yeah, we have talked about it. So we do have an affinity for it, that's for sure.
So were you guys fans of the very good N64 pod racing game? Because I love that game more than Mario Kart.
Quadranero,
wow.
He's my man.
Odie Mandrell. All right, I think we're losing our audience here.
Yeah, all right, for the one person still listening. I wish the movie ended on that T-Bird. I'm going to say it. I don't like the cards.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, how'd you guys feel about the cards there?
I thought there were more. Like, I remember it being, like, way more, and now I think that Animal House really nailed it. Like, they, you know, that's... It works better for me there. Here, it feels like a downer.
Oh, yeah.
It's a super downer. And, like, I don't want to leave... I never really want to leave a movie, like, depressed. I mean, come on.
Especially one that left you on such kind of a high note.
Yeah.
So just to clarify, the first one, it says, John Milner was killed by a drunk driver in December 1964. So, you know, not long after
2 years later.
Yeah. Terry Fields was reported missing in action near An Loc, so Vietnam, in December in 1965. Steve is an insurance agent in Modesto, which is also depressing. And Kurt and Kurt Henderson is a writer living in Canada? Like, it's just so random.
Well, I think the implication there is that he's a draft dodger.
Oh, shit. Good call.
I never got that.
Good call.
Because, I like that.
Because I think all of this, and, you know, if I was to make one George Lucas special edition change 40 years down the line, I get why it ends like this. Because, again, tying in with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, no spoilers for that, it's about the end of the era, or people in that era not knowing it was the end. And that end comes so hard for them between the Kennedy assassination, Vietnam, all of that stuff, that I think at the time, this movie, for what it was trying to represent, it needed it. I think now that stuff doesn't really affect me at all. Now I wish it just ended on the T-Bird, but I get why it's there. I get it. I just don't care.
I like that. I like that. But that's definitely, like, you know, an art house touch too far maybe for me at this point, you know, where it's like, you should have just gone with the happy ending. You had to twist the knife, didn't you? And it's like, all right, because we are getting the point, right? Like, we all know what year this takes place, you know, and if you know your history a little bit, and I guess that's the same as Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It's like, if you know your history, you're going to get way more out of just, you know, watching shit unfold and knowing that there's, like, a looming, ominous presence in the world happening somewhere.
Yeah, no, I agree. Just a note on this scene. A lot of people, even at the time, asked, why don't we get any information on the girls? Like, what happened to them? And one famous critic at the time even called the film misogynistic because of it. And the reason George Lucas said that he didn't do that is because he thought that would make the ending feel too long, which is kind of weird because it would just take, like, two more seconds, you know, but I don't know.
I mean, you could have easily just added a line that Ron Howard married his girlfriend, you know, and they lived together in Modesto or something, right? Or divorced her, and then they got divorced 4 years later.
That's more accurate, yeah. I think the tone they set.
Maybe if he wasn't trying to fit them all on one, you know, page there, he would have added them, but I think starting with Animal House, they do it for like every character having it in their own frame, right? With like the black bar on the side. I think that's kind of like Stand By Me, and I think all of those movies kind of ape that one, and not quite this. They like perfected this example of it. And yeah, I didn't really think about that, honestly, because it really does feel like the movie is built around those four guys. But and I think it's probably implied that if he's still there, it's because he's with her. But yeah, and I mean, It's not a terrible point that there's just nothing about them at all.
No, because, I mean, they're not... I agree with it. I mean, it's not something I saw, but once I read it, like I said, I agreed with it because, at the very least, Ron Howard's girlfriend, sorry about the names, and the younger girl really shine as a character. So if you're going to do this, I mean, what's like another line or two about them? But, I mean, it is what it is. Mm-hmm. It didn't like ruin the film for me or anything like that.
Well, I mean, if you're really dying to know, you could watch even more American Graffiti. Ugh.
I didn't know that existed until today.
Neither did I.
And I'm so mad. Like,
really?
I don't... Mike, have you seen it? Have you seen it?
I've tried to watch it two or three times. I'd love to try it one more time, but it's like kind of unwatchable for me. It's just... Oof, it's rough.
It really pisses me off, like, that it exists. I hate when this happens. I talked about this on The Last Picture Show, which is another, like, early 70s film we did for this podcast, and they eventually made, like, a sequel in the 90s, and I'm like, why? You know? This one came out in 79. Do you guys want to hear how they updated the fates of the main characters, or no? Up to you.
I mean, yeah, why not?
In the movie? In the sequel?
In the sequel, yeah.
Yeah, the sequel, it's very different.
All right, yeah. I bet I'm going to be real mad about this.
Okay, so John Milner is shown driving his yellow Deuce Coupe towards another vehicle's headlights on New Year's Eve. After disappearing over a small hill, neither his taillights nor the approaching car's headlights are seen again, hinting that the crash in which Milner was killed. The anniversary of John's death is mentioned in both sequences. So, I guess he actually does die. Is he in it? I don't know.
I remember him being in it. He's like a... I thought he was like a professional drag racer now or something. Maybe it starts with the end.
Yeah, okay. So, the film spans four consecutive New Year's Eves from 1964 to 1967. So,
it's just why?
So some of it is before the death and some of it is after. Okay, whatever. So, that his fate is the same in that one. It's just dumb. So, Terry the Toad fakes his own death in Vietnam. Disillusioned with the war, he decides to desert, saying that he plans to go to Europe. Terry's supervisors believe him to be dead, as does Debbie in 1966 and Stephen Lorre in 1967. Okay.
Are you... He pulls the old Don Draper, huh?
Yeah, right? I could really see Toad, like, grabbing his dead friend's freaking dog tags and wearing them home. And then going back to Modesto and being like, guys, can't call me Terry anymore. My new name is Travis.
So one of the main characters here is Joe Young, the leader of the Pharaohs. And he's killed by a sniper in Vietnam after promising to make Terry a Pharaoh once he returns to civilian life. So I guess they have a storyline together.
It goes to Vietnam. Are you shitting me?
I need to watch this now and hate on it so much.
This sounds like a horrible adaptation of a Stephen King novel that never was even written or something.
Okay, so Stephen Lorre's relationship is strained by her insistence that she start her own career. Steve forbids it, saying he wants her to be a mom to their young twins. Oh, gosh.
I mean, that seems like something that character would do. He was kind of a dickhead.
Mm-hmm. It's true. I just don't want to see it.
Yeah.
And then free-spirited Debbie Dunham has switched from Old Harper whiskey to marijuana and has given up her platinum blonde persona for a hippie groupie one in a long, strange trip that ends with her performing with a country and western musical group.
What the
This is fan fiction from someone who double-featured this in Forrest Gump, and I hate them.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. That's the worst thing I've ever read. Yeah, that was pretty bad. Okay.
Yeah, thanks, I hate it.
And it wasn't directed by Lucas, but he picked the director, the writer-director. His name is Bill L. Norton. Never heard of him.
Oh, I mean, you know, George Lucas, also the creative mind and genius behind Howard the Duck. So, you know, pick the writers and directors for that and at every executive decision.
And Howard the Duck also shot in that same California town, by the way.
Really? It doubled for Cleveland?
I guess so.
Did Coppola produce that? Because he has a tendency to go one sequel too many.
Brian, what's kind of funny is, I know I was recently on one of your intros talking about Corman, and Coppola's first movie, I think, Dementia 13, is on the marquee. In this,
oh, really?
In this movie, and I think it would have been in theaters at the time this movie actually took place, and that is actually, I think, his first film. He was working for Corman, and he directed Boris fucking Karloff.
Wow.
If you can imagine that. Yeah, just insane. So
that's awesome.
And there's also, I think, elements of this movie, The Terror, or something like that, later on, that used shots of Dementia 13, and I think Dick Miller is in Dementia 13 also, if I'm not mistaken, so it was a real Corman affair, but even back then.
Awesome. Yeah, that's why you're the resident historian, Mike. That's why you're the resident historian.
And I was in theaters back then watching it for the first time as a feisty 12-year-old.
All right, so let's forget more American Graffiti, and let's just go back to the glory that is American Graffiti. So Rotten Tomatoes has it at 96% by the critics, 84% by the audience. But, you know, we do things a little differently nowadays on High School Slumber Party, as you know. We rate by grade. So A+ to F or F- or whatever. I don't think that's come to play today. But what do you guys want to rate on your report card for American Graffiti?
All right, well, so, you know, this time watching it, I'm definitely giving it an A+ this time. I mean, this movie has always had an A for me, an A grade, and I understand why people, you know, might not dig this movie, believe it or not. Like, some people might think, like, the sound is annoying, or, you know, the cinematography isn't good or to their liking because it's not super crisp and all that kind of thing. But this movie just pushes all my buttons, and it's what I love about, like, this stage of American cinema. Dare I say, this might be my favorite George Lucas movie that he's ever directed. Like, don't get me wrong, I'm a huge Star Wars fan, but, like, A New Hope has never been my favorite out of the series. It's not my least by any means. I'm not saying it's a bad movie. But I just think, like, this represents George Lucas, like, entirely. Like, if you watch this, I think you get a better understanding of who he is than if you watch Star Wars. You know, for me, this is way up there at the top. Give him that grade. You know, way to go, George Lucas.
All right. How about you, Chris?
I'm going to give it an A. It is fantastic. I think it is quintessentially American. I think it is a movie that you can point at when someone says, like, what is an example of, like, American culture, like a purely American movie. You know, it's like this and Easy Rider, like the two earliest examples of those kind of movies that I think I would point to. It like I said, the DNA of this movie is all over this podcast, like through all of the things it inspired and the tropes and ideas that were pulled from it and originated here. It's an important movie. It's a great movie. And much like when I was on Myth of the American Sleepover, I'm not sure that this is a movie, though, that an actual high school student today would enjoy in any way. So we kind of talked about that with that episode, how it's like it's a high school movie for people who are out of high school. And I think that nostalgia factor is even more amplified here. I'm surprised that works because I have no love for like 50s greaser rockabillys. I'm sorry, Mike. I have no interest or love for that culture or that time. So like the fact that I still think the nostalgia works in this movie is, I think it says it's really fucking good at what it does.
Yeah, no, I agree with you there. We've seen it a lot on this podcast, even going back to Christine or Mike, a film we did together, Hello Mary Lou, Prom Night 2. There has been some, a lot of 50s nostalgia, this is early 60s, but you know what I mean, like pumped into these films. And it doesn't always hit for me, but I loved this film. This might be now one of my favorite films overall. That could just be because I'm watching all these high school films, but this is everything I wanted it to be and more on this watch. So I'm giving it that A plus, my rare A plus here. But it's awesome. I can't wait to, like, again, recommend it to people who haven't seen it, because there are plenty of people who haven't seen this film. And I think you all should. But if you've listened this far into the podcast, I'm sure you have. If not, we pretty much explained the entire film to you and probably ruined it. But watch it anyway. It's just awesome. A plus. Sleeping bags, guys. What kind of sleeping bags do you want to bring to the sock hop slumber party today?
I got my official Wolfman Jack sleeping bag. You might not have thought they'd make that because marketing isn't what it used to be.
But I'm sure he, Wolfman definitely deserves a sleeping bag, a fucking lunchbox, his own cereal. I mean, the man, aside from Alan Freed, he's like one of the men at this time, I feel like, you know, represented rock and roll, and like, you know, it's just great. I just love his image and all that kind of thing, so I'm going to put it on my sleeping bag.
That's for sure. I'm trying to see if there was ever a Wolfman Jack lunchbox.
Probably not. I don't think he really lived to be that old either, right? So, I think this is his sort of one of his legacies right here.
How about you, Chris? What sleeping bag you bring to the slumber party?
Well,
today?
Seeing as I just received a full scholarship in Fortnite to this school, College Back East University, the colors of that school. The only way that where he's going to is referred to is the College Back East. So I want that university on my sleeping bag.
Nice, nice. I could see it right now. That's great.
I wonder what their mascot is.
It's a good question. You guys will both know this segment at this point, but next segment is rent two movies, get one movie free. I'll let you both pick one movie that we'll watch, theoretically, at our slumber party after American Graffiti.
So I'm going to steal my answer from an article I was reading about American Graffiti from The Dissolve, rest in peace. So it's a dead website anyway. So it's not really grave robbing. It's just, you know, reappropriating. They mentioned when they were talking about the closing credits, like they were talking about how it's used in Animal House as well and a lot of other movies. And then they realized that Animal House takes place in 1962. So, like, the graduating seniors of this movie could be on that campus as college freshmen. And, like, I think let's double feature that. I think that'd be really cool.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. Good call.
Wow, that's awesome. I was going in a way different
direction.
That's
fine. That's fine. It's our slumber party. We can do what we want to, girl.
So, hey, girl. So, a movie that came to mind while watching this, mostly due to the style, that like very naturalistic style and, you know, almost that fly on the wall aspect of it. Like you're there, you're just hanging out. I know we mentioned stuff like Dazed and Confused and things, but the movie that really came to mind is Kids. So, you know, I don't know which one you want to watch first.
It's going to be an interesting night, that's for sure.
Like, as far as American cinema goes, like, that's probably the next most naturalistic, like, shot movie I think I can think of. Who would have ever compared the two or whatever, but I'm putting it out there.
That's awesome. That sounds fun. Those are great recommendations, guys. I really appreciate it. So it seems like it's the end of our drag race. Hopefully it's not a fiery mess, but anything you guys want to plug? I mean, I guess plug your shows and such.
You have like 30 shows. I'll go first so this can get cut better. Speaking of nostalgia, we talk about a time that I guess, as I mentioned earlier, I don't actually have any nostalgia for anyway, because we're at about 2008 right now. We're covering the Now That's What I Call Music discography, volume by volume, over on Now and Again. And we are right about 2008. Lady Gaga's about to hit, so very... by the time this comes out, who knows where we'll be. So if you're into pop music, if you're into that era, or just kind of hearing two guys laugh about those times and such, Now and Again, come check us out.
Awesome.
You can catch me on a few shows, but a lot of them coming back this year. We just did a new Cage Club episode. He finally released the film this year. It's incredible. I suggest everyone go check that out. We're going to be coming back soon on Keanu Club with John Wick 3. Watch the Throne. We just did the Long Shot episode. That's out there. Cinemakers is sort of asleep for the moment, but lots of great back episodes to that series. Fridays are for fun right about now, as Brian is aware, because he also has his show on Friday. But also check out Alternating Fridays every other week, the Tom Tom Club, where Joey and I are watching the entire cinema. We're watching all of Tom Hanks and Tom Cruise's movies, alternating weekly, comparing, contrasting, talking about enjoying, getting ready to enjoy the rest of Hanks, already enjoying all of Tom Cruise's stuff. So we're real deep in there now. We're starting Tom Hanks's Golden Mile, or whatever you want to call it. We just, at the time of this recording, watched Joe vs. the Volcano. I think the Mission Impossible episode for Cruise is out about now. That was a great rewatch. And then I got the Third Time's a Charm, which is every third of the month. You can check me out there talking about the third film in a franchise. And
Mike,
all
if,
that
if I'm not mistaken, I think that Cinemakers Christopher Nolan season had an extremely brilliant and handsome guest host, right? Everyone should definitely go.
yes,
go listen to
that's
that.
Very true. The enigmatic Dr. Chris podcasts.
Well, thank you guys so much for chatting about American Graffiti with me. It was a blast. I hope you guys had as much fun as I did. It's really good to talk about a really great film, you know?
Yeah, tell me about it. Over on Third Time's a Charm.
Doesn't happen too often there, but we still have fun there too, that's for sure. All right, thanks so much, guys.
Catch you on the flip side.
Later.
Awoo! Wolfman Jack here. Hope you really enjoyed that episode on American Graffiti with some awesome guests. My main man, Mike Manzi, and my other main man, sorry, that really, really hurts my voice. Big thank you, as always, to Mike Manzi. Big thank you to Chris Podcasts. I think we just, you know, I think we all liked that film, but we gained a new appreciation for it, watching it again and discussing it. And that's one of my favorite things about High School Slumber Party. Because, you know, you watch a film and you have your opinions, but when you talk it over with everyone, that's when you really form your opinion, for better or worse. But, this movie's amazing. I can't recommend it enough. Go George Lucas, you know, this guy's he's got potential. I think he could do big things one day. Well, next week, we are moving into a completely different direction because, as mentioned, it was Thanksgiving yesterday, and it's the holiday season now, officially. Some people put up the tree before Thanksgiving. Ugh, heathens. Now it's the time, you know? Now it's the time to decorate. Now it's the time to celebrate your Christmas, your Hanukkah, your Kwanzaa, whatever it is, until we make that push to New Year's Eve and we celebrate that. But let's enjoy December and let's enjoy the beginning of the holiday season with what else but a Hallmark Christmas movie. You're surprised, right? Well, there are not too many high school Christmas films, but we got some this year, I promise. And we're going to start off with a film I'm sure you've never seen, but I want you to track down. It's called Homegrown Christmas.
Sometimes life...
Maddie can take over the dance with Carter.
I can.
And the holidays can take you full circle.
The two of you were meant to be.
Lori Loughlin and Victor Webster star in an original Countdown to Christmas movie.
Well, that's the funny thing about dreams. If you believe in them, they come true.
Homegrown Christmas on Hallmark Channel.
Yeah, we're doing that. But of course, we have a great guest. He's a Lifetime expert. He's been on this show before. You may know him from Too Fast, Too Forever. That's Joe Too, and I can't wait to have him on. I hope he's a Hallmark movie expert as well, because this one's going to be interesting. And guys, it's hard to find, but not impossible. Just Google it. Seems like the Hallmark Channel tried to wipe this from history once Aunt Becky got in a little bit of legal trouble. But we'll talk about that next week. Thank you so much, guys, for stopping by, listening to all our chat about American Graffiti. Happy Thanksgiving, and happy holiday season. I leave you with another song from the Great American Graffiti soundtrack. Let's get that nickel again. I know you're not sick of this. Let's put it in the jukebox. The song is called Good Night, Sweetheart. Some places it's listed as Good Night, Well, It's Time to Go. But I know the band is the Spaniels. Good night, everyone. Later, dudes.
Good night, sweetheart. Well, it's time to go home. Good night, sweetheart. Well, it's time to go home. I hate to leave you, but I really must say, oh, good night, sweetheart. Good night. Good night, sweetheart. Well, it's time to go home. Good night, sweetheart. Well, it's time to go home.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.